If you're looking for the next episode of the Far Middle Podcast, you've come to the right place. Welcome, episode number 19. 19 brings to mind that Steely Dan song, Hey 19. Steely Dan's one of those rock groups where the first time I heard them, instantly was at least astute enough to recognize they were super talented, hyper talented musicians, a cut above what you typically hear with rock acts. But it took me years of hearing them on FM radio to get an appreciation for just how good they are in their music. They're very similar in that regard to the rock group Yes. The same thing with Yes, where first time you hear them, you know they're very talented, but they're so complex, the music's so complex, that it takes you a long time, if you're a novice like I am when it comes to music, to get an appreciation for them. But nevertheless, here we are with episode number 19, and we're going to stick to that process that we've been employing in prior episodes of connecting dots. We've got five of them to connect today. We're going to move efficiently through them. They are gems of timely topics, and they all fall in the category of you can't make this stuff up. So let's get started with our first dot. And the first dot is the issue of how this unforgiving ideology of the left that you see on most of our elite campuses, colleges and universities, it's creating graduates who come out of college less marketable to employers in the real economy than when they went in. They're basically, they being the students, are coming out in worse shape as graduates than when they went into the elite university or the elite college. And a lot of people that look at this or assess this or talk about it, they categorize it or label it as being woke. I think that is a bit of an oversimplification. Instead, what's going on, as I see it, is much more serious than just something like microaggressions or whatever you would label under being woke. I think Ivy League, elite schools, the graduates subscribing to being woke or woke attributes when they exit or graduate, that's occurring, but that's just a symptom. The root cause, when you get down to it, are that these elite institutions, and when I'm speaking of these institutions, I'm talking about their faculty, I'm talking about the bureaucrats in their administrative bureaucracy, which is vast, the curriculum, all of those things, they are implanting, injecting, stamping, and I think all those words are appropriate, leftist ideology onto or into its subjects, the students. And worse yet, the leftist academia culture that you see out there, it's also coupling that leftist ideology with a very aggressive, take no prisoners demeanor to help deploy the ideology beyond the quad far after graduation day. So it's not just the ideology that's being implemented onto the student or into the student. It's also this demeanor that's very aggressive, almost angry, when coupled together, really creates a heck of a package, and perhaps a package not in a positive way with respect to someone entering the workforce. And what that produces are students and ultimately employees who are hypersensitive. Frankly, they're soft. They can be thin-skinned. They come across as being angry and very entitled. When you couple all those things with a less sound employee when it comes to being trained in the fundamentals of their craft, so why are they less sound in the fundamentals? Because they were busy taking all these required courses that injects and teaches them all the leftist propaganda when they were at university. So over those 4 years, more and more credit hours or more and more hours within a class that is a fundamental nuts and bolts class is dedicated to this type of teaching of ideology. You have less credit hours or less instructional hours to focus on the fundamentals, the nuts and bolts of whatever your profession is. That's why you are less trained in the fundamentals if you're a student exiting an elite university today than one that did so 10, 20, 30 years ago. But when you see that, you start to realize as the employer on the other side of that transaction that what was once a great rate of return on investment into people, right, human capital, it's now a horrible rate of return. You're actually doing yourself and your endeavor and your enterprise a disservice. It's a negative rate of return, a value destroyer, so to speak. You increasingly have two types of graduates that I see coming out of elite universities. And this is really sad to say, but nevertheless, it's an accurate observation from the perspective of an employer or business enterprise. First, you've got those who have become indoctrinated and are now going to be disruptive in the workplace. So basically, you're bringing in a dysfunction or dysfunctional element into your team. And then you've got those who learn to play the game early and they've kept their mouth shut and they don't say what they've been basically taught to not say what they think. Now, neither one of those instances, whether you've got the indoctrinated who are very disruptive or whether you've got those who basically play the game and keep their mouth shut and don't say what they think, neither is the type you want in a workplace if you're looking for a culture of transparency and excellence and responsibility and ownership. So that's why, whether it's scenario A or scenario B with the type of graduate from an elite university that you're dealing with, it's going to present a problem when it comes to creating value through human capital as an employer or as a business. But to be academically consistent, since we're talking about academia, there is an interesting exception to the real economy increasingly rejecting the opportunity to hire these elite college graduates, which brings us to our second dot, which is how major public corporations, some of the biggest company names or corporate names that you see out there, they ultimately see an opportunity to hide behind things like social justice and being woke, et cetera, to avoid more serious and tangible issues that they don't want to account for, talk about, or answer for. Now, what am I speaking to here? Let's look at a couple of examples that I think make the point clearly. Just take about any CEO from a public corporation that goes to Davos. Now, they typically are going to get there and travel there through private jet, private charter, which is a mode of travel none of their frontline employees enjoy, and one that, of course, spews an egregious carbon footprint to boot. Now, those are optics problems. That creates an optical issue for that CEO and for that company. And the CEO isn't going to change his or her travel plan. So forget the silly ideal or the crazy idea that they're going to have to lead by example. That's not going to happen. They're not going to fly commercial. So what the CEO does is when in Davos with their other elite yet hypocritical colleagues, they're going to lecture all of us on how climate change is an emergency and a crisis. And there's this urgency to drive to a zero carbon economy. Basically, they're going to go speak and lecture on the big, the abstract, when their discrete decisions, literally on how they got to the lectern to give the lecture, it flies in complete opposition and contrast to what they're lecturing about. Another example would be, you see this like with apparel companies, right? They could be clothing, shoes, whatever, but apparel companies that make billions of dollars off of what I think is a really ugly circle, an ugly supply chain. And that circle is using foreign oppressed, or in some cases, slave labor, literally slave labor, under horrible work conditions to make apparel and shoes for next to nothing. And then those entities, those corporations are going to sell them at ridiculous markups to impressionable customers. And a lot of those impressionable customers are young and poor. It's one of the most ignoble, inhumane, and manipulative business models that you're going to find on the planet. But those same apparel companies are going to market the hell out of zero carbon pledges and rights for the oppressed, living wages, right? Corporate responsibility, social justice. You're going to see that stamped all over glitzy ads on TV, the internet, billboards, et cetera. And then I'll give you a third example. Let's take a massive multi-hundreds of billions of dollars investment firm, and there's many out there that fit the bill, that will sort of push and demand from its investment holdings that they offer public acts of contrition on things like what? Like pay equity, carbon footprint, you know the list. But then those same investment firms, they are pouring billions and billions of dollars into China. And they're going into investing into Chinese companies that are basically nothing more than extensions or fronts for the Chinese Communist Party. And they're going to help that nation oppress its people, spew more carbon as they grow their economy, militarize Asia, and erode individual rights. Everybody knows this. And the firms pour all that money into these Chinese shell ventures without demanding anything close to what they demand from Western company holdings that they invest in via these progressive stances and lectures and policies that you hear about. Very inconsistent. So you see what's occurring here across these examples. And we could go on with additional examples. I'm sure you know of a few that come to mind on your own just listening to the podcast. But what's occurring here is you've got really smart, savvy, multi-billion dollar corporations that figured something out. They figured out that being woke and social justice, those things are the perfect veneer, cover, camouflage, costume, whatever you want to use to describe it, to hide behind, while the nuts and bolts and the dollars and cents and the tangible and measurable business models and decisions, they continue to be as brutal as they get to maximize the almighty dollar. So there is an exception to that first dot, which is the second dot. And it's created a very convenient opportunity for some of the largest corporations in the world to basically talk one thing, but continue on with these brutal business models behind the scenes. These corporate charades lead to the third dot for the Far Middle podcast today. That's how this practice can manifest into the leaders of these corporations and their personal lives. This subject coincides with the wider ranging topic of elite hypocrisy that we discussed in prior episodes of the Far Middle. And I'm still mulling over a page on the website, nickdeolias.com, to highlight and list these specific examples of elites in entertainment, business, and academia, saying one thing and then doing something very different. But today, let me focus on the man, and that's Jeff Bezos of Amazon fame, the almost $200 billion man. It sort of reminds me back in the heyday of television of the $6 million man. Remember that? Lee Majors. What was his name? Steve Austin. That was the name of the character. Astronaut. We can rebuild him. We have the technology. I remember the $6 million man. Maybe you do too. But back to Jeff Bezos, a great doer, a value creator, a capitalist, no problems there at all with his wealth, an admirer of what he's accomplished. The problem is with his lectures and optics versus his personal decisions. The two are very different. And first, you've got the optics. So he announced $10 billion of his money that he was going to pledge to fight climate change. I thought that you placed the climate czar John Kerry on the job, that would suffice in and of itself, but Jeff Bezos and others maybe don't think so. Anyway, what it meant was he was giving billions of dollars to various environmental organizations, and it's been a who's who of that big subsidy-eating complex. You had $100 million each to the Environmental Defense Fund, the NRDC, the World Wildlife Federation. You had tens of millions each to many other environmental organizations. And most of these entities, they spend vast amounts of money on bureaucratic staff and brochures and advertising and lobbying and so on. In other words, less than you think goes toward actual impact and impacting the real world on the environment. But nevertheless, this is America. And at least for now, a person is free to do with their money whatever they please. So that's not the issue here. The issue is what he is doing with his personal life and how that contradicts his rhetoric on fighting climate change and what the beneficiary environmental organizations demand from their followers and from society. So these personal decisions and personal life are flying in conflict with or contrast with his rhetoric and what the environmental organizations who are the beneficiaries of these donations demand from everyone that's out there in terms of how they live their lives. Now, he owns houses, as in plural. He owns them in Seattle, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., New York. He owns tens of thousands of acres in Texas. Just looking at some of these, his Los Angeles Beverly Hills home is the Warner Estate. That was named after the co-founder of Warner Brothers, so it's got a lineage that's pretty impressive. 13,000 plus square feet, paid $165 million for it. And rumor has it he bought the house next door, or close by his Warner Estate for close to $10 million. So he doesn't seem to like neighbors, so he just buys their places next to him. In June of 2019, he dropped about $80 million on three adjacent New York City apartments in the priciest real estate deal ever that was logged or recorded south of 42nd Street in Manhattan. He's got 29,000 square foot mansion outside of Seattle. He bought a former museum in Washington, D.C. for his Washington home, 27,000 square foot. It's the largest home in Washington, D.C. And his real estate portfolio in total, it's estimated to be worth about $300 million. And of course, he owns private jets, as in plural, not just one. $160 million worth was the estimate of Gulfstreams, etc. Now, I think you see the problem with the hypocrisy. So Amazon is all about fighting climate change. And its founder makes tax advantage contributions to the tune of billions of dollars to fight climate change. And then when the camera lights and the mic are turned off, He goes to massive mansions that are his homes and private jets to get to and from, where he produces perhaps the largest carbon footprint of any single human being on the planet. Yes, as Bezos and Amazon show, the hypocrisy of CEOs often mirrors that of their corporations. The two sometimes go hand in hand. And Bezos and his fight against climate change, that jumps us to the next dot. And that is how the largest of investment firms that are out there may be applying two different standards when it comes to their U.S. and their Chinese investments. And the biggest of the big, right? BlackRock is an example of this. I think they've got $9 trillion under management, which is pretty hard to fathom. I mean, hats off to them with what they've achieved. But the biggest three investment firms, BlackRock being one of them, to just put this in perspective, those big three, they hold a quarter of the voting control of most public companies in the United States, which is equally hard to fathom. That's just as hard to fathom as $9 trillion of assets under management. So these firms like BlackRock and their colleagues or their competitors, they're now working on calculating and assigning metrics. One example here is a temperature alignment metric. I'm not sure how they're calculated or the specific formulas, but they're trying to apply these and calculate them for individual stocks and bonds that the investment firm holds. And the attempt is to try to figure out how much each company behind the stock or the bond warms the planet. So that they're trying to basically almost assign a climate change indice and a score to each individual stock, each individual bond. And then, you know, based, I guess, on those scores or those scalings or those rankings, press for change or press for whatever issue they're going to lobby or press for. But this whole process of things like temperature alignment metrics, that's only for U.S. and European companies. These investment firms and investment houses, these really large ones, they also announce, right, that they've got plans or they're currently jumping into financial services and offering financial products in China. So I think the thought there, right, the strategy is that those 1.4 billion Chinese, they may offer a very lucrative market and growth area for firms like BlackRock and the other behemoths of the investment world, the financial services industry. But, you know, of course, this being China, where you're looking to create some new clients and a new business growth strategy, the Chinese Communist Party in that market sets the rules for access to that market. And they are sticklers when it comes to doing things their way or the highway. The Chinese Communist Party doesn't care much about climate change or temperature alignment metrics of Chinese companies. So I'm betting that these very large financial institutions that are looking to grow into the Chinese market, I'm betting they're going to drop that exercise of things like temperature alignment metrics for their Chinese holdings. So there's nothing like holding companies in a free enterprise, democratic, pro-individual rights countries to a harsher standard than those in oppressive nations. That's a big problem. If you're holding and setting standards that are very demanding for corporations that operate under a much more favorable environment and in a favorable way when it comes to individual rights and democracy and free enterprise, versus companies that are operating in markets or nations like China, and you're creating more lax standards or no standards at all on things like climate or temperature alignment metrics, that's a massive issue and a massive problem when you're looking at how you sort of structure your responsibility under investment thesis and investment rules to live by. And I wonder how many big corporations out there, whether they're in financial services industry or elsewhere, how many big public corporations officially recognize the reality of a country called Taiwan? That would be an interesting exercise to run down, name by name, which publicly traded corporations in the United States or in Europe will officially recognize the existence of the nation of Taiwan. And we were told that the only deniers out there were those who dared to challenge the cult of climate change. And that brings us to our last dot for this episode of The Far Middle. And that is going from the financial services industry and climate change and China, and now shifting to China and the United States when it comes to setting policy on climate. So on one side of this, we've got Team Biden, and Team Biden has climate czar John Kerry leading the charge. This is the side that says climate change is the top threat to U.S. national security and, frankly, to the world. So not North Korean nukes, not Iranian nukes, not the Russian bear on the prowl, not failed credibility with the fall of Kabul, not terrorism, COVID, or the Chinese Communist Party. Nope. All of those pale next to trace amounts of CO2 going up in the atmosphere. Now, on the U.S. side, we also have a scary reality of the climate czar having a personal history of appeasement that sort of makes Neville Chamberlain look like Churchill or Margaret Thatcher. So remember those pallets of cash that we ended up flying to Iran to get a deal done. What happens when the climate czar is frothy for a global climate deal and has to include China in that deal to give it some emphasis and some credibility? Now, on the other side, we've got, of course, China and the Chinese Communist Party. And you've got to admire the dedication to their strategic interests and objectives. They see our climate czar coming before John Kerry's private jets even fire up its engines, and they prepare to completely dress down and fleece the United States in the process. The Chinese foreign minister, Wang Yi, he did just that when he provided a list of wrongs that the U.S. must stop to our climate czar and to the world. One of those things is to stop shutting down Chinese espionage in the United States. How dare we? And another is to back off the defense of Taiwan. That's an obvious one, front and center. Now, if our climate czar, Kerry, if he lusts for a climate accord and a Nobel Prize that goes with it, and his boss is coherent enough to realize his numbers stink and he needs a reset and a win through something like a climate treaty, I'd expect China to exert maximum leverage and to extract maximum value. And they're going to do that strategically, tactically, and probably permanently. Now, if you want proof of this, our climate czar said the other week during his visit to China that his talks were, quote, very constructive and detailed, end quote. Now, let me tell you, let me sort of translate for you. That's elite speak BS. That's all that is. China's foreign minister, he had a different soundbite that he chose. He said, quote, cooperation on climate change cannot be divorced from the overall situation of China-U.S. relations, end quote. He's clearly pressing for and will achieve leverage and tangible results because of it. I'm worried about this. I think you should be too. Our guys are taking knives to a gunfight. Our guys care only for the optics and the BS. Their guys are astute. They're playing a long game, and they aim to achieve, as I said, permanent advantage. Whoops, there goes Taiwan. There goes the South China Sea. There goes our technological know-how. And there goes a whole lot worse, I fear, that are going to follow. So those are our five dots that we've connected in this episode of the Far Middle Podcast. And yes, those five dots and their connections, they prove once again, in the words of the Kinks, it's a mixed up, muddled up, shook up world, to say the least. Again, this is Nick Deolius. You can follow me on Twitter at Nick Deolius. Give a look at the website, nickdeolius.com. And we will be back shortly to talk again and cover some interesting topics with episode number 20 shortly. Till then, take care and stay safe.